Welcome, listeners. We're back, the Power Hour. Alan Meyer sitting in for and guest hosting for Daniel Brigman. I am joined by my good friends Douglas Gibbs and Roman Valenzuela. As the advertising closed, remember, the Power Mall. You can visit it at thepowermall.com. You can call them 877-817-9829, Monday through Friday, 8 to 4 Central Time, because when you buy from them, you are buying from the good guys. Where we last left off, we were going to begin our discussion of the Federalist Papers, starting with Federalist Paper 1 and Federalist and Anti-Federalist. And the reason I like to do these tandem is because they were produced, written around the same time, and they generally cover the same topics from two very different points of view. As Doug mentioned, the Federalist Papers, those in support of ratifying the Constitution, were mainly written by Alexander Hamilton, some by John Jay, some by James Madison. Alexander Hamilton wrote the first one. It was published in October 27, 1787, not that long after the convention ended. His intent was to make arguments that favored the ratification of the Constitution. He spoke about the inadequacies of the present government, that would be the Articles of Confederation, the necessity of what he would say a strong and energetic government, and its relationship to the Republican principles of government, that is, a republic. Now, there were people who concluded that the country at that time, I want you to think about this, at that time, and let's, well, around 1790, you had just under 3.9 million people in country. And some people at that time felt that that was too large of a country, too many people to actually have a national system of government. But Alexander Hamilton continued, and he felt that even though this had never been done before, and this had never been done before for such a large area and population, it was the conventional wisdom that this is not going to work. Any opening thoughts, Doug, on Federalist One and Alexander Hamilton?
Federalist One was an introduction, essentially, and indicated that there were arguments against the Constitution. The Anti-Federalist Papers hadn't even begun being written yet, but the arguments, the letters to the editors against the Constitution had already emerged. The idea of a new Constitution had originally been Alexander Hamilton's idea. He was the one that brought it up during the Annapolis Convention in August of 1786. And he was right. We did need a bigger government to handle the country stuff, the external stuff, let the states handle the internal stuff, which was a new concept. Typically, you had national governments that controlled everything. This would be a federal government that would handle only external issues, but let the states still handle their own stuff. And so it was an experiment. It was something new. Hamilton, however, was a big government guy. He wished it was a nationalist system. He believed that America was the next great empire. And while the founding fathers, his colleagues at the time, agreed that the reach of America would be worldwide, they did not believe it would be because of conquest, as Hamilton had hoped for, but that it would be out of emulation, that the system of liberty was going to be so awesome, was going to do so well, was going to be so prosperous that other countries around the world would want to emulate it. And that was the idea. The Anti-Federalist Paper was an immediate response and definitely put out the dangers of having a larger government and defended the Confederation under the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation had been hasty. It had been written in 1777 during the war. It took 4 years before it got ratified. constitutionally took a year to get ratified. So it tells you the difference between the documents right there. But what the Confederation did is it left all of the powers to the states, giving the central government only the authority to wage war and declare war.
Well, thank you for that, Doug. The one thing I would add is, and this is so important, I think, for all of us to understand, is the environment that this document was created and what it was intended to do. And, Doug, you touched on it was to deal with the rest of the world for the 13 states in a unified, uniform voice. The only other power, this is my understanding, that the federal government would have is it would deal with interstate squabbles. It wouldn't deal with what was going on within a state. It would only deal with the interstate squabbles, and those were plenty. It could be over waterways, it could be over borders, you name it. Basically, just keep the states from taking each other out and deal with the rest of the world. But they still felt, as we're going to get into it, that the country at 13 states and less than 4 million in population, some people felt this was not possible. But that was Alexander Hamilton's introduction. Now, the Anti-Federalists, and they were written under many different names. Oh, I'm sorry, before I go on, even though Roman is getting new to this, he did order his own Anti-Federalist Federalist Papers, his book. Roman, any thoughts?
So it's honestly, it's just more of a comment. The Federalist Papers were and still remain an important collection today because what they did is they offered insight into the intentions of the key individuals who debated certain elements of the Constitution. Now, what's important about that is that people had a platform through these papers in order to bring about a discussion. Discussion is something that is very, very relevant and important whenever coming to terms on a common goal and idea, hence the Constitution, which would further be instilled in this country. So the reason why, multiple reasons why I bought it, but one of the reasons why is because it also strikes a bell with some of the projects that I've been working on, Alan, that we'll touch on later, currently. And so it's very important to see all sides of the discussion before moving forward in anything.
Thank you for that.
Roman, you have to understand, the Constitution was a very polarizing issue. The idea was they had just fought big government in the American Revolution. Now these guys are saying, oh, we need big government. And everybody's like, no, we have the Articles of Confederation. We don't want big government. It's tyranny. And so, but Alexander Hamilton, when he decided to help launch these Federalist Papers, he correctly foresaw how polarizing the Constitution would be and how polarizing it was, and has a quote, a torrent of angry and malignant passions will be let loose. You think that the arguments today, the battles today are rough. Over the Constitution, the entire country was one side or the other, and really there were three sides. You had the Federalists who believed that the Constitution was, as it would be followed, the direction we needed to take. The Anti-Federalists, who were against it and wanted to stay with the Articles of Confederation. And Federalist 1, by the way, is very critical of the Articles of Confederation. And then you had the Nationalists, people who thought that the Constitution didn't go far enough. A lot of people forget that that group existed, that the Nationalists believed that there should be a big government, a bigger government than what the Constitution would allow for, that got involved also in domestic issues. Really it came down to the Union. How was the Union going to survive? How was it going to prosper? And Hamilton, in Federalist One, he explained that the Constitution was necessary for the Union to prosper, that the Union would not stand the test of time under the Articles of Confederation. It needed the Constitution to stand the test of time. That government, while everybody was worried about government, it had to have some power when it came to dealing with external issues. And as I like to say, under the Articles of Confederation, what we had was a lamb. What we needed was a lion. But the fear was lions eat people. How do you create a lion but keep it from eating everybody? The Constitution would serve as the shackles and the cage for that lion.
Thank you for that, Doug. Another thought in this vein is that you have the Federalists, as we're calling them, the anti-Federalists, those who want to be, don't have a central federal government. And you still might have some lingering Tories, those who long to be still part of Britain. But the idea was, from what I've learned, with the Federalists, they want the central national government, deal with the rest of the world for all of us, deal with interstate squabbles, and other than that, hands off. The anti-Federalists were thinking possibly more than one, maybe up to three or four, what they would call confederations. A confederation would be three, four, five different states, and they would have their own little small unit. So there was a lot going on at that time. And everything that was they were talking about from the Federalist and the anti-Federalist point of view, they were breaking new ground. There wasn't really anything like this ever in the world. And the fact that this document, the history leading up to it and from it, is really not taught in our basic education, but they're worried about the other topic we already dealt with, gives me a great fright as to what is being seen as important in our education today. So now the anti-Federalists, this is the anti-Federalist one. They feared that multiple factions would threaten personal liberties. They felt that a large centralized government would not be able to truly represent the people. And the first one is written by somebody with the pen name Brutus. Brutus felt that the proposed Constitution consolidated too much power in the hands of Congress at the expense of the states, and that people were best protected by 13 states continuing to be confederated republics. Basically, they're all on their own, and they just agree to somehow work together. That the anti-Federalists were advocating for a small, decentralized republic. In his first essay, some of the important questions that were posed by Brutus included, is the confederated government the best for the United States? Should the 13 United States, each one an individual political sovereign entity, be reduced into one republic governed by one legislature under the direction of one judicial and executive branch or branches? Or should they continue to be 13 confederated republics? What Brutus really worried about was that the federal government would, note the term would, not as in, and I could see that being in the future, not at that moment, would become too powerful. That the central government would be given too much power, which might lead to despotism or worse. And that state governments would not function as republics and possibly become obsolete. He also thought that and I know you've spoken about this a lot, Doug, common defense and general welfare was a broad meaning and could be abused. That ultimately states would find it difficult to support themselves, leaving them dependent on the federal government. He didn't like the idea of the Confederation being lost. Doug, any of your thoughts on Anti-Federalist One?
Well, Brutus, no one has really determined exactly who Brutus was. There's suggestions that it may have been Melancton Smith or John Williams or even Robert Yeats, though Robert Yeats was later identified as being another author. The importance of number one, and the Anti-Federalist Papers, by the way, are generally attributed to Robert Yeats. This was a very compelling rebuttal to Hamilton's opening argument. Rather than championing the Articles of Confederation, it demonized this new constitution and what could come out of it. And two clauses, which would render the various state governments powerless, according to Brutus, were very dangerous, and that was the necessary, proper, clause, and the supremacy clause. Those two, he felt, negated the power of the states and were very dangerous. Later on, Hamilton would use those clauses to put in place implied powers. So Brutus was right that there would be those who would try to use those clauses to make the federal government stronger and to do whatever it wanted. Little did he know, he was addressing the very person that would be behind it, Alexander Hamilton. And he didn't believe, Brutus argued that none of these restrictions, none of these things that were in the Constitution imposed any actual limitation on the legislative powers under the Constitution. He believed that with the General Welfare Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause, that the legislature had the authority to pretty much do what it wanted and would do whatever it wanted, regardless of what the original intent of those clauses were. And what you'll notice within yourself, and I'm talking to you listeners out there, as you study the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers, is the more you get to know the Anti-Federalists, the more you begin to appreciate what they were warning, because we are now seeing today the very things they are warning. I'm not saying that the Constitution was a bad thing. The Constitution was well written, and if it was followed due to its original intent, we would not be in the trouble we are in. But the Anti-Federalists weren't arguing that the Constitution was bad. They were arguing that the Constitution would create a system that would eventually not care about the Constitution and go way beyond the Constitution and do things that are tyrannical despite the Constitution. That was really a large part of their argument.
Doug, thank you for that. I got a question, serious question.
Okay.
If you could choose any of the framers of the Constitution, and these would be those who were on the Federalist side, and you brought them forward to today, and they could see all that the federal government does today, controls, owns, I mean, even just the fact that it has property in so many states and almost owns all of Nevada. What do you think they would say? Would they say, this is what we intended?
You know, there's a book by a gentleman by the last name of Bowman. I can't think of his first name off the top of my head. And it's actually called What Would the Founding Fathers Think? And the opening image on the cover says it all. It's an image of the cartoonish picture on the cover of the book is Ben Franklin, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and their jaws are crashing on the ground as they look through their little portal into the future. And they would, you know, realize that the Anti-Federalists knew what they're talking about. And I think that had they, if they knew what was going on today and they had to do it all over again, there would be more clarifying language. For example, they would define natural born citizen right there in the text. They would define what they meant by the Commerce Clause, which doesn't mean anything across the state lines gets regulated by the government in the way that they regulate it, but that government would be a mediator in case there's a dispute whenever things cross state lines. That's really what was originally intended based on their writings. But they would have actually inserted that language right into the Constitution. I really do believe that had they the hindsight, the 2020 that we have, they would have clarified the language more. The Constitution is a fine document. It's a wonderful document. The original intent is exactly right. The problem is we have judges and politicians interpreting it to mean other things because in their minds the language is general and vague and can be played with, you know, all they want to play with it.
Thank you. We're about to run out of time on this one, but I want to comment on what you said and that, you know, as you've mentioned before, these people are writing with pen and ink. And, you know, they don't have a word processor, so they're going to keep it tight. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that it was very clear to them. And for anybody who has actually studied the Constitution and these people, it would be clear, especially when you put it in conjunction with what is being said in the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist Papers. Yet we have an educational system, thank you, Department of Education, that does not instill this knowledge, does not bring this inquisitiveness into the students, which means if you don't know what your prize is and how important it is, you can't possibly know how it's being taken from you.
Right.
And the one thing that, because we're about to go to break, the one thing the founders did not instill enough is people. People in posterity, the future. You need to know what this says, so you need to know, so you can protect and defend it. We'll be right back after these important messages. Stay tuned, please.
What in the world is this crazy Willard water?
It's a proprietary solution, and it's a water additive that was invented by my grandfather, Dr. John Willard, and hence the name Willard Water. Boosts a number of different things. We see most prominently that it's increasing the absorption, utilization, and storage of nutrients in the cells. So, for example, if people were drinking, we see a big boost in B vitamin absorption utilization. If you see it in plants, we see a big boost in their ability to absorb and retain fertilizers or nutrients in the soil. So we see with things like microbes. If you used a microbe on soil, for example, to replenish the soil, and you sprayed our Willard water on it, go through that replenishing cycle much faster.
Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at theparamall.com. That's theparamall.com.
If you eat your mammoth food on a semi-regular basis, you're probably getting better quality food and healthier for your body than you're eating now.
Your products are GMO-free. There's no added MSG and no chemical preservatives or high fructose corn syrup. And you also have gluten-free products as well.
We have a great variety of very high-quality products.
Call 1-877-817-9829 right now and buy from the good guys at theparamall.com. That's theparamall.com.
My husband is a welder by trade, but he grinds his welding products, and he doesn't wear a helmet or a mask to do that. And he had this cruddy stuff in his lungs, and it just wasn't going away. And I heard you one time talking about the Sera enzyme for the lungs, and my goodness, I mean, he can breathe so much easier, and I don't hear that crud in his lungs. Thank you
so very much.
To find out more about this product or others like it, go to our website at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com. Call 877-817-9829. That number again is 877-817-9829. Jay's standing by to take your call. Now more than ever, we need your support. Buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
The Power Hour has been in existence since the turn of the 21st century. It is more critical than ever for you to sign up for our free newsletter and our breaking news. Simply text the word Power Hour to 22828 on your mobile phone, or sign up when you visit thepowerhour.com. Our website again is thepowerhour.com. Text Power Hour to 22828. Together, our legacy will live on for centuries.
Boost your immune system naturally this year with oil of oregano, a potent germ killer. This is the true wild oregano oil P73, a blend of edible spices of wild oregano grown on natural mineral-rich soils. Research published in the International Journal of Food Microbiology found that oil of oregano is an excellent germicide capable of killing a wide range of fungi and bacteria. Get it today by visiting thepowermall.com or calling 877-817-9829.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
Welcome back, listeners. You are listening to the Power Hour. Alan Myers here, sitting in for Daniel Brigman. I'm joined by my friends and guests, Douglas Gibbs, Roman Valenzuela. Remember, if you want to buy from the good guys, you go to the Power Mall, powermall.com, or call them 877-817-9829, Monday through Friday, 8 to 4 Central Time. We last left off, we were finishing up on Anti-Federalist 1. Roman, any thoughts on Anti-Federalist 1?
Just to kind of wrap it up and get the conversation going, just to harken back about having how important it is to have a discussion about both sides of any topic, it's crucial that these came about because, you know, it led to the ratification of the eventual ratification of the Constitution, which was contingent on a Bill of Rights. And so that's what, if anything, is so important about these anti-federalist papers. And so, like I said, it's interesting to know both sides of the aisle.
Douglas, any thoughts?
Political and civil discourse is important for liberty. If we don't have a discussion, if we don't have our debates, liberty dies. That's one of the reasons why I'm so frustrated with the cancel culture, political correctness, all of that jazz, because what it does is it kills the debate. I have no problem with the other side debating with me, arguing me in the arena of ideas, as long as that's what it is. It sharpens our tools in our shed, so to speak, and in the long run, it makes for better legislation because of the debate. When there is no debate, when one side controls everything, that's when liberty dies.
Thank you for that. My last thoughts on the Federalist Papers, Anti-Federalist Papers, and is that these are must-reads. to be able to be taken back into that time period, to begin to gain an understanding of what was wanted, what fear came, what they were afraid of, which of course is too much power centralized that is not in your control. That's what they were afraid of. And it would be, and I'm going to have to check out that book, Doug, that you mentioned, because I would really, I mean, it would be incredible to really understand what the founders, the framers would think and feel if they were brought here today. I personally think they would just be so disappointed. This is just way too much. And before we move on, Doug, please take a few moments, plug yourself, plug what you do, and where people can listen to you.
Well, I am known as, in the circles around the radio, online, and in person, as Mr. Constitution, or that Constitution guy, depending on who you're talking to, America's Constitutional Authority. I've been teaching classes on the Constitution since 2008. I currently have 6 live classes in Southern California. I have one time a week on Tuesdays at 3 Pacific, Scott McKay. You know, for those of you who are Patriot Street Fighters out there, good to see you're out there. And he's actually in Southern California right now. Last night I was at an event with him in Anaheim. I'm going to be in San Diego tonight and Riley's Farms up in the Cherry Valley, Oakland area, Tuesday night, tomorrow night. And also, if you want to learn more about what I do, I've written 7 books, 6 of them on the U.S. Constitution. You can go to douglasvgibbs.com or politicalpistachio.com. On those sites, you can also join my email list. I do videos daily. Matter of fact, I've just started a new series called The Daily Dose, where I do a video daily, except for some reason on Saturday I didn't get one out because I don't know, there was this radio show that was in the way. That radio show is on KMET 1490 AM, 1 to 3 PM Pacific every Saturday. And I've got 2 co-hosts, a gentleman by the name of Dennis Jackson, who's vice president of the nonprofit that I am president of, the Constitution Association. And then the other co-host is the guy you might have heard of, especially right here on today's program, Alan Myers. And Alan serves as a great co-host and also a guest host often. Did I forget anything? Because I know there's so many things I do, I always forget something.
No, well, you could talk about how much Dr. Pepper you drink, but other than that, you're doing good.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, U.S. Constitution is a passion of mine. And folks, if you want to see me do the classes online, the Thursday night class in Carlsbad is also Zoomed. You can go to 1776foreverfree .com to check out how to watch that on Zoom. 1776foreverfree .com. Definitely get on my email list. Get on Political Pistachio as a regular reader and visitor my YouTube channels and so forth. Because yeah, I tell you what, you hang out with me long enough, you might learn something.
Thank you, Doug.
You're very welcome.
Now, Roman. Roman and I are recent acquaintances. Yes. Roman, a little bit, so people understand a little bit about you, where you come from, and what you and I are now doing.
Yes, thank you. So, just a little background on myself. I was born and raised in Fresno, California, so California native. I was an only child and attended private Catholic school from kindergarten to senior year. So after graduating high school, a friend and I packed all of our stuff in a van and moved to the lovely city of San Francisco. Now, the journey of self-discovery that I went through there and making a living on your own with no help at all greatly shaped the person that I pretty much am today. I lived there for 13 years. And so to bring us now to the present, I currently am the producer at Seamless Podcast Network. I have a background in communications and video editing, which is what led me to producing. At Seamless, we create content that is edgy, relevant, and diverse, which is what exemplifies the lovely city of San Diego, which is where Alan and I currently reside. Now, you can find all our content on seamlesspodcast.com, and it ranges from everything from cybersecurity to relationship issues to Alan and I's latest venture, which is Focal Point, which we'll be getting into shortly.
All right. Hold that thought, Roman. We're fortunate. We have a caller. Tom, from Michigan, I believe.
Yes. Welcome to the Power can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. A couple of things. You know, you were talking about how the language has expanded, where the federal government is grabbing more power. And you mentioned a couple of things. What they call the Commerce Clause is one, where they call it interstate commerce, okay? But, you know, of course, the Constitution says commerce between the several states, okay, and commerce between the U.S. and foreign nations. The Indian tribes. The thing is, you know, I'm not a state, okay? Like, if I'm in federal statute where the feds grab jurisdiction over me, I mean, why can't I just say, well, Your Honor, I'm not a state. You know, this, what you call the Commerce Clause, doesn't even apply to me. Because obviously that, you know, states can't impose tariffs, you know, from one state to another. That's in another place in the Constitution. And, you know, I think they said exactly what they meant, that it has to be, that would be an example of, you know, commerce impose tariff. General welfare, when you're talking, a lot of people, I've heard people say that that's the implied intent of that is basically means what it says. It really only applies to defense, but there are other things where they had to put general welfare in there. That's why general welfare is in the preamble differently than in the Constitution. And I just wanted to add that, and, you know, if you think I'm crazy or you think, you know, you want to talk about it?
No, not at all. Thank you for those wonderful comments. I'm going to make a few comments, and then I'm sure Doug's got a couple things to say. The, you know, with the commerce and the states, there was a Supreme Court decision, and Doug will know it and I don't know, but the upshot of that decision was that some guy is growing wheat or hay or something, and I think it's the Depression period, and he decides that he is not going to sell this. He's going to use it for his own consumption. And a federal court case went to the Supreme Court, and Doug will correct me if I got this wrong, that this guy was affecting interstate commerce by not selling. Therefore, the Supreme Court had jurisdiction on this case. This is incredible overreach. This is exactly what the framers did not want to have. And that is, they never dreamed of an ever-expanding government. Because, well, you deal with what's going on outside with the rest of the world, and you deal with interstate squabbles, and that's it. Doug, any thoughts on this?
The two clauses that were brought up, Commerce Clause, General Welfare Clause, are two of the most misinterpreted clauses in the Constitution. When it comes to the Commerce Clause, you're referring to Wickard v. Filburn, 1942. And that was the case in which, basically the Supreme Court solidified the idea that the government could be could regulate, make law, tax, or do anything to anything across state lines at any time by anybody. And if you go back to the original writings, the original debates based on Madison's notes and the different letters from the time, what you realize is that the Commerce Clause was not supposed to mean that. The word regulate means to put good order from their point of view. So in other words, the federal government has no authority over anything that crosses state lines unless it's not in good order.
Hey, Doug, hold on just a minute. Hey, Tom, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Could you mute for a moment because there's noise coming in from whatever you're calling in on. I want you to stay with us. Just mute. Thank you. Go ahead, Doug.
So a Commerce Clause originally meant that the federal government was to act as a mediator, beginning with the legislature, then the courts, a mediator whenever there was a dispute between commerce. I also want to correct our caller. The states, according to the Constitution, cannot charge tariffs against each other. They were doing that prior, and the Constitution disallows that. So they cannot charge tariffs on each other.
I thought that's what he said.
Oh, I thought he said they could. Okay.
No, I thought he said he didn't. They didn't.
Okay. But anyway, get to the General Welfare Clause. The General Welfare Clause is not a clause. It's a condition that's met if the federal government's doing its job. We know this because the father of the Constitution, a guy that might know something about the Constitution, James Madison, who's not only the father of the Constitution, he was there, he took notes and all this other stuff. When he was president, and you knew this was coming, you've read this. James Madison, as president of the United States, near the end of his presidency, the Congress put forth a bill to fund highways and boatways. In other words, you know, federal funding for our roadways, you know, which is common today. And James Madison vetoed that bill, saying it was unconstitutional. There was no authority for the federal government to fund roadways, boatways in any way, shape, or form, which is still true to this day. And in his veto, he explains because the Congress used the one of their excuses for it was the General Welfare Clause, and he explains what was meant by the General Welfare Clause, and he says in his veto of the 1817 bonus bill, this is not what we meant by the General Welfare Clause, that you can just, you know, say, oh, if it's for the general welfare, we can do whatever we want. If that's the case, then there's no limitations on the federal government. It's a condition. It's a general condition of all's well throughout the country. If the federal government's doing its job, general welfare will be promoted. It was never meant to be an excuse to do whatever they wanted. So anyway, I hope that answers your question, sir.
Thank you, Douglas. Tom, does that help?
Yeah. You know, there's one other thing. Maybe when you talk about the Whiskey Rebellion, where they put an excise tax on people, you know, distilling their weed into alcohol for storage. You know, I think that should have been vetoed. That to me appears to be an unapportioned direct tax. You know, they're trying to charge an excise tax on, you know, an individual private, you know, farmer within a certain state or another state.
And whiskey was also used as a form of currency at the time. People traded it because it was good for so many things. And the Whiskey Rebellion was regarding the whiskey that was the low grade whiskey was made on the remaining less quality wheat. And eventually that tax was done away with. Alexander Hamilton, the big government-minded founding father, was the guy behind that tax. But eventually that tax was rescinded after all of that happened. The great thing about that Whiskey Rebellion was when George Washington showed up, everybody dropped their arms, not only because George Washington was such an imposing figure and a well-respected individual, but he was also surrounded by many members of the state militias from surrounding states who were the locals. And this is the way it's supposed to work. The federal government's not supposed to impose themselves with some military force, but to work with us with the local militia and the local people. That said, the federal government's domestic authorities are so few and almost non-existent. The very fact that the federal government has to ever come into any area for any reason really betrays the Constitution in so many ways.
Thank you, Doug. I'm just going to wrap on this with a couple comments. Doug, you brought up what was called the bonus bill. And if that bill was put out today or in the last 100 years, no president would ever veto it.
Well, in fact, it was. It's called the Interstate Highway Bill.
Yeah. So they wouldn't veto it. But the guy who helped write the Constitution, Mr. James Madison, fourth president of the United States, a guy you'd think who knew what happened at the convention and what the Constitution was all about, vetoed that bill. Gives you an idea of what we really don't understand about our Constitution and its power. And I think the Supreme Court began to go rogue right after John Adams appointed John Marshall to the court as the Chief Justice.
Yep.
So, Tom, thank you for calling in to the Power Hour. We appreciate your comments and your interest. Call back again sometime. You take care and be safe. Well, we only have – thank you, sir. We only have a few more minutes left. Roman, let's talk real briefly about our podcast focal points.
Sure.
And why we do it.
Well, so the purpose for Focal Point, in my opinion, is to be a voice for those of us who want to see compromise and who want to see both sides talk about things that actually matter and are relevant to the causes they are pushing for. Now, having a background in communications has provided me insight in that the very art of having a proper discussion with just the facts is something that is somewhat lacking now. I feel like you can agree, correct?
Wait a minute. Are you confusing emotions with facts?
No, I'm not.
I didn't think so.
No. So, you know, we want to take on serious issues in a non-combative nature. And so, you know, Alan and I come from completely different backgrounds and upbringings. All of these serve as an example of what it is that we are trying to achieve here. Even all of the topics that we've discussed on the Power Hour, just recently right now. But despite our differences, there needs to be the platform to hold a discussion, not a debate, which is something that Alan and I like to point out, but a discussion, because the only way that we will ever reach common ground is if we put aside our differences and realize that at one point we're all right and we're all wrong. Now, this is what I hope to achieve with Focal Points. And the reason why Alan and I chose to go plural with the name, because we had originally decided on Focal Point, but now it is Focal Points, because in the grand scheme of things, there isn't just one focal point, but a multitude of focal points. That is what makes living this country and learning so great.
Thank you, Roman. I'll add a few things. Yes, I am about the conversation. I don't want conflict. I don't want confrontation. I want conversation. Maybe at the end of it, we won't agree.
No.
But the important thing is, and this is why I believe Roman and I can do this, and this is kind of what this show has been about today, is the conversation, and that when you take the attitude of a student, you want to learn. And it's not about being right. It's not about making someone else wrong. It is about learning, constantly learning more, learning what's important, learning what our duties as citizens in this country are, learning about how we can help give back, even if it's just local. These things are not government territory. These are personal. This is personal. People to people. Community. And when people start taking back, this is my thoughts, when people start taking back control of their local environment, school board, city council, whatever, by letting the people know that are in office, and my terminology for them is elected employees, and using the way the Constitution was written, when you have a common noun that is just common noun, lowercase first letter. So to me, elected employee is lowercase e, lowercase e. When you're dealing with a common noun that is important, you capitalize the first letter. All of us on this program, everyone listening, we're all citizen owners. Capital C, capital O. It's time the owners wake up, stand up, and start telling their employees what to do or fire them. But we have not been educated to think of ourselves as owners. And I sometimes use the analogy of a business. How well is a business going to run, operate, be profitable, succeed, last, if the employees tell the owners what to do? It's not going to happen. Well, we have come to the end, amazingly, of our time here on the Power Hour. I want to thank everybody associated with the Power Hour for helping us get the show together and inviting me on. Doug, as always, thank you so much. You gave me my first shot in radio back in May of 2018. Roman, thank you for participating, being on the show. Any last words, Doug, real quick?
PoliticalPistachio.com, DouglasVGibbs.com. United we stand, combined we kick butt. God bless America and God bless you.
Roman, any last words?
SeamlessPodcast.com is where you can find all our content. Focal Points will be listed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and all of your popular platforming.
Well, thank you very much. To the listeners of the Power Hour and Daniel Brigman, thank you so much for this opportunity. Really enjoyed it. And to all you patriots out there, and you know who you are, you lovers of life, liberty, freedom, individuality, may you be and stay safe and well.
Heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.